Kazambi at the TV. "Where's Ma?" I said. He wouldn't answer me. I went out to the kitchen and came back with cereal, milk, a bowl, a spoon. "Shove over," I said. Flopped down on the couch next to him. The proximity was a half-baked attempt at peacemaking. "So where'd you say Ma and Ray were?" I reached over and clapped my hands in front of his face. "Hey, Thomas, wake up. Where are they at?"
"Who?"
"Ma and Ray." "At a picnic," he said, still watching the tube. "Ray's union picnic, that's today?" No response. I looked down at my brother's hand on the couch cushion next to me. His fingers and fingernails were bitten to shreds, the skin red and raw, dried blood in the cuticles. I got up and tried Dessa again. Maybe I'd have better luck on the downstairs phone, but there was still no answer. I sat back down next to Thomas. My leg was tapping against the floor a mile a minute. I poured myself more cereal, ate a few spoonfuls, and put the bowl down on the coffee table. "Me and Dessa had a big fight last night," I said. "It was my fault." The disclosure just slipped out. Took me as much by surprise as it did Thomas. He looked over at me. "Nothing too serious, though," I said. "Nothing we can't straighten out. You and her will really have to meet each other one of these days. I think you'd like her. She's good people. I want you to meet her sometime." "I'm going to meet her tomorrow afternoon," Thomas said. "What? What are you talking about?" I felt suddenly panicky. "She called this morning. While you were still sleeping, she thought I was you."
"Dessa?
What'd she say?"
"She told me what happened last night."
I just sat there, trying to figure out how to respond.
"What do you mean, what happened?" I finally said.
"She said you forgot your bike in her car. She's going someplace all day with her mother and her sister, but she said she could come over tomorrow afternoon and bring it back. She wanted to know if I was going to be around so she could meet me."
"Yeah?
She say anything else?"
"No."
I was suddenly overwhelmed with relief, overwhelmed with sympathy for my goofy brother.
"Hey, Thomas, about this roommate stuff," I said. "Leo just asked me one day, you know, it's not like this master plot against you or anything. I figured I'd make a change. It'll be good for you and me. That's partly why I did it, for you."
He laughed at the baldness of the lie.
"Hey, don't believe me," I told him. "I don't give a crap, but it's the truth."
He muttered something under his voice.
"What?"
"Nothing." Neither of us said anything for a minute or more. If Thomas was going to meet Dessa, he had better not embarrass me. As a matter of fact, now that I thought about it, he wasn't going to meet her, not yet. I'd find some way around it.
"So, what's with the stocking cap?" I asked him.
"What are you wearing that thing for in the middle of the summer?" But Thomas was on some other wavelength.
"Would you do me a favor?" he said.
"Depends. What is it?"
"Would you just stop playing Mr. Friendly Brother? Because it's not convincing at all. I know what all three of you are up to."
I laughed.
"Who's all three of us?"
"You and your two buddy buddies. You've been plotting against me all summer. I have all the information I need." That crazy note I'd flushed down the toilet the night before came flying back at me again.
"Whatever you're talking about, you're full of shit," I told him. "What are you, paranoid or something?"
"No, I'm just aware."
"Yeah? Aware of what?"
He yanked down the stocking cap until it nearly covered his eyes. Then he picked up the TV guide and started ripping the pages into strips.
"Hey, that's the new one, asshole," I said. "What are you doing?"
In response, he started screaming at me.
"Cut it out," I warned him. "Stop it."
And when he didn't stop, I grabbed him. Jumped on him and made him stop. He screamed loudest when I yanked that fucking hat off his head. He began fighting back with more strength than I thought he had. The two of us toppled off the back of the couch, knocked over an end table, rolled across the floor. A lamp fell. It didn't break, but the shade got bent to shit. When I got on top of him and pinned his shoulders to the floor, he lunged up and spat in my face. That was it. I popped him one in the nose, put him in a chokehold while he was trying to get away from me.
gave him a couple of good jabs in the ribs and tightened my grip around his neck. He gagged, went limp.
Okay, 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 he said.
I let go. He coughed, cleared his throat. We were both out of breath, both scared, I guess. I got up and righted the coffee table, the end table lamp, threw away the wasted TV guide, vacuumed up spilt cereal, bent the lampshade back in place the best I could. Thomas just sat there on the floor, rubbing his arm over and over. Down in the cellar, I got my fishing gear ready, checked my tackle box, my lures. What was wrong with him? Something must be wrong. Just before Leo was due to pick me up, I went back inside the house. Thomas was still sitting on the floor where I'd left him, still rubbing his arm. The cap was back on his head. You hurt your arm, I asked him. No answer. Is it sprained or something? You okay? Nothing. Part of me wanted to deck him again, and part of me wanted to reach down and pull him off the floor. If I were you, I said, I'd turn off the boob tube and go down to the store and get another TV guide. Ray sees you wrecked a new one. He's going to go apeshit. Thomas looked up and faced me.
You are me, he said.
Come again.
You said if you were me, you'd buy a new TV guide. But you are me.
No, I'm not, I said. Far from it.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. Thomas's smile was private and serene. My heart thumped, wild with fear. I was outside in front, waiting on the wall, when Leo pulled up in his Skylark. I threw my fishing gear in the back seat and got in the front. Could you do me a favor, as long as we're going out to the bridge, could you stop at Dell's first for a couple of minutes?
Dell's, he said.
Dell's house? I told him about Dell's wife's car. He lives out near the old mill on Bickle Road, I said. All right, Birdsey. All right, but I tell you, man, the last thing I want to do after I've been looking at Dell's ugly puss all week is go and fucking visit him on the weekend. I found the Valiant Dell was selling sitting in a yard at the end of the street. It was faded red with black and white checked upholstery. The body had cancer. Two of the tires were bald. You could wobble the tailpipe with your foot. The garbage out by Dell's back porch was ripe and overflowing. About a zillion flies lifted off it as we passed. The porch steps were rotting away.
This is exactly the sort of dump I expected him to live in, Leo whispered.
I rapped softly, squinted through the screen door. Somewhere inside, a TV was blaring. I rapped again, louder. Wait a minute, someone called. Then Ralph Drinkwater was at the door, shirtless and barefoot, as dumbstruck to see us as we were to see him. For a couple of seconds, the three of us just stood there. What the hell are you doing here? Leo finally said. Ralph looked flustered. He disappeared back inside for a second, and then came back again, yanking on a shirt as he pushed past us.
I was just leaving, he said. He had his shoes in his hand.
Hey, I called after him. Is Dell home?
How the fuck should I know? Ralph said, not bothering to look back.
At the front sidewalk, he broke into a run, shirt tails flying behind him. Leo and I stood there watching him go. I remember thinking, stupidly, that he'd just killed Dell, had come to Dell's house and murdered the bastard, and then by some quirky twist of fate had run smack into us. What other reason did he have for being there? Why else would he be running? I waited for another couple of seconds, trying to figure out what to do. Then Leo turned the screen door handle and walked in. Hey, Dell, he called. You home? No answer. It's Leo and Dominic. We came to look at that car. From down the hall, I heard Dell cough.
I thought I told you to call first.
I would have, I said. But we were going fishing, and I just thought we can come back some other time if...
I'll be with you in a couple of minutes. Go out back and give her a look.
We just did, asshole, Leo whispered.
We stood there waiting. The place was a pigsty. Dirty dishes and clutter everywhere you looked. There was a half-eaten grilled cheese sandwich and a half-drunk bottle of 7-Up on the coffee table.
You know what I think, I said? I think Ralph lives here.
No shit, Sherlock, Leo said. You catch on real quick.
Leo started flipping through the magazines.
Hey, Birdsey, get over here, he whispered. He looked quickly down the hall for Dell.
Check these out.
Mixed in with the Rolling Stones and the Head comics were homo magazines. On the cover of one, two guys were tonguing each other. On another, some dude was straddling a Harley, wearing just a biker jacket.
They're queers, Leo whispered. Ralphie and Dell, they're queer for each other.
No, they're not, I said. Dell's got a wife.
Yeah? Where is she, then?
And whose magazines are these?
Hers?
Down the hall, a toilet flushed. Come on, I said. I'm going outside. I'm getting out of here. Dell came out a minute later, calling to us from the porch. I couldn't look at him. I needed to get the fuck out of there almost as much as I needed that car.
I jumped the battery and started her up after work yesterday, Dell said as we went around the back. She sounded good. Here, let me start her up again.
Dell backed his Galaxy out of the garage and inched it toward the Valiant until the bumpers clunked. We put up the hoods, connected the jumper cables. When Dell's hand brushed against mine while he was checking a connection, I jerked it away. Dell told me to get in the Valiant and start her up.
So what do you think? He said. Sounds good, don't it?
Sounds all right, I said. You mind if we take her for a test drive?
She ain't registered and has no insurance. My wife let everything run out.
The three of us stood there staring at it. Then Dell reached inside and turned off the ignition. The yard went uncomfortably quiet.
So, Dell, Leo said, what's the story with Ralph?
His eyes narrowed.
What do you mean, what's the story with him?
Well, he answered the door a few minutes ago. Does he live here or something?
Dell shoved his hands in his pockets, jingling his change.
Yeah, he lives here. Him and me and the missus. You got a problem with that?
Leo said. We just didn't know he lived here, that's all.
Neither of you ever mentioned it. You two related or something? For several seconds, the two of them just stared at each other.
I'm white and he's a nigger, Dell finally said. What do you think?
So anyway, I said, about the car. Dell took his time finishing his staring contest with Leo. Then he turned to me.
I'll let you have it for $400, he said. That's a damn good price.
I told him I couldn't afford $400, that I'd already told him $200 was all I could afford.
$200 for this car? For $200, I might as well let it stay right where it is and be a goddamn lawn ornament.
$250, then, I said. I can't go any higher than that. He spat on the grass, said nothing. Okay, $275, then. That's it. That's my last offer. He stood there, smiling and shaking his head. It's got over 78,000 miles on it, Dell. That tailpipe could go tomorrow. I'd have to get insurance, register the thing.
Yeah, he said. So?
You said yourself it's just sitting here. I need a car.
We all need things, Dickie Bird. $375. Take it or leave it.
I shook my head. Leave it, I said. He shrugged.
No skin off my nose. See you Monday.
We were halfway across the lawn when Leo made a U-turn and walked back up to Dell. I followed, oblivious.
You know, it's like you were saying yesterday, Dell, Leo began. What the guys on our crew do is nobody else's business, right? Like us smoking a few joints, or you getting cocked on the job 2 or 3 days a week, or harassing my buddy's brother to the point where he's in tears, to the point where he...
His brother's a little dickless pansy ass, Dell said. Quits his job over some stupid little thing like that. I can't help it if he's...
Hey, you know what I could never understand, Dell? Leo said. I had no idea where this was going. I can never understand why you've been so interested all summer about what Dominic's brother's got inside his pants. Why'd you go on and on with that dickless stuff all summer anyway, Dell, huh?
Dell looked nervous, vulnerable.
Stupid kid can't take a little bit of teasing. That ain't my problem. That's his problem.
Yeah, I guess, because what us guys on the crew do is nobody else's business, right? Not Lou Klukey's or anyone else's. Like, for example, the living arrangement you and Ralph got going out here.
Lou know about you two being roommates, Dell? Come on, Leo, I said, turning to go. He doesn't want to sell me the car? Fine. But there was a smile in Leo's eyes. He stayed put.
How long has he been living here, anyways?
You and Ralph been roommates for a short time or a long time?
We ain't roommates, Del said. He sleeps on the couch, on and off, since his mother took off for parts unknown.
Leo put his hands in his pockets, scuffed at the dirt with the toe of his sneaker.
Yeah? That right? Was that while he was still a minor?
Now there was genuine fear in Del's eyes.
Well, whose fag magazines are those in there? Leo said. The ones in your living room? They're yours or his? Or do you share them?
Del crossed his beefy arms across his chest, looked from me to Leo, moved to within a few inches of my face. The truth was this. In a fight, he could have probably killed both Leo and me.
What is this, Dicky boy? He asked me. Blackmail? You and Big Mouth here trying to blackmail me?
Was the tremor in my face visible? The winner of this one was going to be the guy who didn't flinch first.
No, this isn't blackmail, I said.
If this was blackmail, I'd be asking you to give me the car, but I'm not. I just want you to sell it for what it's worth. Just when I thought the worst was coming, he nodded.
$275, you said?
I looked over at Leo, looked back again. I said $250.
What about you, Big Mouth?
He said, nodding over at Leo.
If your buddy and I make a little private deal here, you're going to keep your trap shut for once in your life?
Mum's the word, my man, Leo said. Mum's the word.
Okay then, Dicky boy. Bring the money over here Monday night. I want a bank check, $250. Make it out to Delbert Weeks.
No problem, I said.
No problem at all, Leo echoed.
Delbert.
Good, he said. Now both of yous get off my fucking property before I change my mind.
He pounded back in the house, slamming the screen door behind him. We walked back up to where Leo had parked his car, got in. Neither of us said anything. We rode for a mile or more in silence. Leo was the first to speak.
Unbelievable, he said. Unfucking believable.
The next day, Dessa and I drove out to the falls to talk. We made up, made love. On Monday morning, I quit the public works so I wouldn't have to face Ralph. On the way out of the yard, I ran right into Ralph. He acted embarrassed, not angry. During mid-year exams, Thomas withdrew himself from school.
What do you mean you withdrew? I screamed into the phone when he called me. Are you nuts or something? Are you crazy?
He was back home in Three Rivers by then, had packed and left campus without even telling me.
Why don't you just go and fucking enlist, Thomas? I shouted. Why don't you just volunteer to go over there and get blown up?
While I was back in school second semester, Thomas stayed home. Stayed up till all hours, Ma said, and then slept all day long, as if he was working the night shift, same as Ray. Something's wrong with him, Dominic, Ma told me over the phone. I think it's more than just nerves. He kept refusing to see the doctor, she said. But what could she do? In February, the Selective Service Board notified my brother that he'd been reclassified from 2S to 1A. In early March, Thomas was ordered to New Haven for his pre-induction physical. Ray drove him there. Thomas passed the vision, hearing, and coordination tests. His heart rate and blood pressure were fine. He was neither colorblind nor flat-footed. He failed the psychiatric examination. Ray drove him back home again.
I don't know, Dominic, Ma said. If you could manage to get home over the weekend, that would be great. I know you're busy, but he's not eating. He won't take a bath. I hear him traipsing around the house all night long. He won't even talk to me anymore, honey. Remember how he used to talk to me all the time? And when he does say something, it doesn't make any sense.
The following Saturday, Thomas and I went to lunch at McDonald's. It was my idea. Get him to take a bath, get him out of the house. He neither welcomed the idea nor resisted it wholeheartedly. Ma said he was having one of his good days. He told me the communists had targeted places like McDonald's.
Yeah, I said. For what?
He said it was better for me if I didn't know. "Hey, what's going on with you, anyway?" I asked him. "Ma says you're having a hard time. She's worried about you, man. What's bothering you?" He asked me if I knew that Dr. DeMarco, our dentist since boyhood, was a communist agent and a member of the Manson family. Dr. DeMarco had drugged him and planted tiny radio receivers in his fillings, Thomas said. It was part of an elaborate plan by the Soviets to brainwash him. They sent messages to him 24 hours a day. Now something had malfunctioned, Thomas said. The radio receivers were heat-sensitive, and Thomas had made himself a cup of hot cocoa and scalded the inside of his mouth. Since then he'd begun to pick up other messages as well. He'd tried to rip out the receivers, but he'd only cut the inside of his mouth. "Yeah," I said. "Let's see." He opened wide and pulled at both sides of his cheeks. There were raw purple gashes on his gums and tongue, slashes in the roof of his mouth. That's when I started to get really scared, when I saw how he'd mutilated himself like that. I felt lightheaded, robbed of oxygen. This wasn't happening, I promised myself. That conversation, and the psychiatric lockup that followed it later that night, Thomas's first, occurred a full 10 months after the panic attack that had made my brother trash our jointly owned typewriter in May of the previous year. In the interim, the war had escalated. Man had walked on the moon, and I'd tried as hard as possible not to see what was coming. What inch by inch had already arrived. On that first night of many nights, when I drove my brother between the brick pillars and onto the grounds of the Three Rivers State Hospital, I went home to our shared bedroom on Hollyhock Avenue and dreamed a dream I had remembered ever since. In it, my brother, Ralph Drinkwater, and I are together, lost somewhere in the Vietnamese jungle, wading ankle-deep in muck. A sniper perched in a tree raises his rifle and aims. No one sees him but me. There's no time to tell the others. I duck, pulling Ralph down with me. There's a dull crack. A bullet rips through my brother's brain. Beep. Hello? Hello? Yes, this is Ruth Rude calling for... Hello? Mr. Birdsey? Oh, I thought I heard you pick up. She was talking in slow-mo, slurring her words. God, I'd hate to see what her liver looked like. Henry and I were wondering why you weren't at the house today. You said you'd be there, so we were expecting you. Her voice dropped to a whisper. Henry's very discouraged. He says the scaffolding in his office window is starting to make him feel like a prisoner in his own house. He can't even work. He's so despondent. Please call. Please. I picked up the phone, flipped through the Rolodex. She picked up on the first ring, her voice as sober as 7 a.m. Oh, she said. Yes, I was expecting a call back from Henry's doctor. I skipped the apology for the no-show the day before and told her I'd try to make it over to their place that afternoon. Tell Henry I should be ready to prime by the end of the week, Monday at the latest. He feeling okay? Pause. Why do you ask? You just said you were waiting for the doctor to call back. She gave me that line again about Henry being despondent. Too much booze and too much time on his hands. That was his problem. I'll try and give you a half a day tomorrow, I said. Best I can do. There's this thing I have to get to tomorrow afternoon. I'll probably work all day Saturday at your place, though. I'll let you go now in case his doctor's trying to call. Shit. If I ever finish that job... ever kissed this painting season goodbye, then maybe there was a God after all. I grabbed my keys. The dump, paint thinner, Halloween candy. What else? What else? Oh, yeah. Pick up my suit at the dry cleaners. Had to look my best for those dipsticks on the security review board the next day. Had to look as sane and conservative as possible. God, I'd be glad when that thing was over. Which reminded me. I needed to bring my notes to my meeting with Sheffer. She wanted us to review our arguments one more time. Yeah, and then what? If they sprung him from Hatch and wouldn't readmit him to settle, what were we going to do then? The truck started on the third try. My eyes scanned the courtyard. Joy had overstuffed the garbage cans again, I noticed. Why didn't she just issue invitations to the goddamn raccoons? Ah, screw it. I had to go to the dump anyway. Might as well just throw the damn garbage bags in back and take them with me. Better than waking up at 2 a.m. and listening to those goddamn scavenging raccoons. I swung bags 1 and 2 into the truck bed. Bag 3 busted open at the seam mid-flight. Motherfucking cheap bags. I needed this. Scooping up the junk mail and dead salad, my eye caught something else. A blue pamphlet. Directions for a home pregnancy test? In our garbage? I got in the truck. Drove toward the hardware store. Did I have those notes for the meeting with Sheffer? Had I remembered my dry cleaning receipt? How could she think she was pregnant? A false alarm, maybe. Missed period or something. Miraculous vasectomy reversal? Not that she knew. I never told her. It was partly a not wanting to get into it thing. The baby's death. The divorce. Partly a male ego thing, too, I guess. By the time I came out of my stupor, looked around to see where I was, I'd overshot the hardware store by 1/2 mile. I was way the hell over past the cinemas and betting barn. Hey, wake up, man. Earth to Birdsey. I sat in Sheffer's office, twiddling my thumbs and waiting. Stay calm, I told myself. Her period was just late or something. Was she cheating on me? Was that it? I was no picnic either, I reminded myself, especially lately. I'd never cheated on her, though. Never cheated on Dessa, either. Never. It was just a false alarm, I assured myself. What's the matter, Birdsey? You don't have enough to worry about? Hey, we discussed the possibility of kids a total of 1 time. We'd both agreed neither of us was interested. No kids was one of her assets, one of the big reasons why I'd asked her to move in with me. Sheffer's entrance into the office made me jump. She was hyper, all nervous energy. Which did I want first, she said, the good news or the bad? The good, I told her. Your security clearance came through. You can see him. I can? When? Today. As soon as we finish our meeting. I'll call security and we'll meet him in the visiting room, all right? I nodded, told her thanks. The unit team took our vote this morning. Things had gone pretty much along the line she thought they would, Sheffer said. Dr. Chase had voted to recommend Thomas's retention at Hatch. She and Janet Coffey, the head nurse, had voted for his release to a non-forensic facility. But here's the part I didn't see coming, she said. Dr. Patel abstained. Abstained? Why? I don't know why. I don't really get it myself. She said she was professionally obliged not to go into it. But that's stupid. That's just throwing her vote away. I got up, sat down again. So it's a hung jury then? Man, this sucks. Sheffer reminded me their team was just advisory anyway. Just the lowly medical professionals who have actually worked with the patient. The security board was the real jury, she said. She told me the team had decided to write up the vote as is, explained that they were split with 1 abstention, so there'd be no clear recommendation either way. She told me we had done everything we could, that a lot of it depended on whether or not the board was willing to check their baggage at the door and listen without prejudice. I'm worried about Thomas blowing it, I said. Does he have to be there? She nodded. We've been over this already. Yes, he has to be there, and yes, he has to answer their questions. She started to say something else, then caught herself. What? I said. What were you going to say just then? She didn't want to worry me, she said, but Thomas had been acting a little skitsy that morning, a little agitated. It was probably nothing, just an off morning. You think they're going to release him tomorrow? She shrugged, told me not to bet the farm. She picked up the phone and dialed, told security that she and I were ready to see Thomas Birdsey. When the guard brought him in, Thomas stood hesitantly at the door, taking me in small, shy glimpses. Hey, buddy, I said, stood up. How you doing? His bottom lip trembled. He looked away. Lousy, he said. It was kind of ridiculous, really. Thomas had to stay seated on one side of the table, and Sheffer and I had to sit on the other side. No handshaking, hugging, or physical contact of any kind. I recognized the guard. He was one of the ones who'd been on duty that first night. Not RoboCop, one of the others. He pulled out a chair for Thomas and told him to sit. Half a minute went by. "Ralph Drinkwater's a janitor here," he said. I told him, yeah, I'd seen Ralph. "Looks pretty much the same, doesn't he?" I said. "Hasn't even changed that much after all these years." "You look good too, Thomas." He gave me a belittling snicker. "No, you do, considering."
"Considering what?"
"Well, you know, your hand, this place. They treating you okay here?" The sigh he let out sounded like defeat itself.
"The food is disgusting."
"Yeah?" I said. "Shit on a shingle, huh?" His hand moved to his mouth, covered it up the exact same way Ma was always covering up her cleft lip.
"They served rice and beans for lunch yesterday," he said, "and wheat bread and canned pineapple. There was a dead beetle in my rice and beans."
Sheffer asked him if he told anyone about it. He shook his head. Ignoring her, he addressed me.
"Remember when we used to take walks on the grounds on Sunday afternoons? You and Dessa and me?"
I nodded.
"I was thinking about that today. You two always used to stop and read the gravestones at the Indian cemetery."
"And you used to take off your shoes and socks and wade into the river," I said. He seemed to drift off when I said that. "Hey, speaking about the Indians," I said, "you hear about the Wakwanics? They won that court case. So I guess they're going ahead with that big casino now, down at the reservation." I'd waited 2 weeks to see him, talk to him, and now all I could do was make small talk. "Going to be huge, I guess, the way they're talking. Las Vegas, too." He asked me if I could do him a favor.
"What?"
"Could I go down to the river, the spot where he and I and Dessa used to walk? Could I get a jar and fill it up with the river water and bring it back to him?" Behind him, the guard shook his head no.
"Why?" I said.
"What do you want it for?"
"I want to wash with it," he said. "I think if I wash with the water from the river, it might help to heal my infection, purify me. I'm unclean."
"Unclean?" I said. "What do you mean?" In the silence that followed, I forced my eyes down to his self-mutilation. The scar tissue was pink and shiny, as soft-looking as a newborn's. As soft as Angela's skin had been. I blinked hard, felt an involuntary tightening in my groin and stomach. "It looks pretty good now," I said.
"What?"
Your wrist."
"I meant my brain," he said. "I think the water might heal my brain."
I sat there, not saying anything, wiped the tears out of my eyes. I probably could have counted on one hand the number of times over the years when Thomas had acknowledged his sickness like that, when he hadn't taken the attitude that he was the reasonable one and the rest of us were crazy. They threw me those out-of-nowhere moments when he seemed to have some inkling of his own sorry dilemma. Those little flickers of insight were almost worse than his Looney Tune business as usual. You'd see for just a second or two who was trapped inside there, who Thomas might have been. Sheffer said she could work on the request, but right now we needed to talk about the hearing. "Thomas, you remember there's a hearing tomorrow night, right? That the security board is going to meeting to decide..." His exasperated sigh cut her off.
"To decide if I can get out of here?" he shouted.
"That's right," Sheffer said. "Now, I'm going to be at the hearing, and Dominic and Dr. Patel. Maybe Dr. Chase, and you're going to be there too, Thomas."
"I know that. You told me already."
"Okay. So what we need to do is go over a few more things with you so that you'll make a good impression with the security board, okay?" Thomas mumbled something about the Spanish Inquisition. "What's one of the things they're probably going to ask you about tomorrow?" Sheffer asked. "Do you remember? The thing we were talking about yesterday and this morning?"
"My hand."
"That's right. And what are you going to say when they ask you about that?" Thomas turned to me. How's Ray?
Thomas, Sheffer said, stay focused. Answer my question, please. What are you going to tell the board about why you removed your hand?
We waited. He put his hand to his mouth and started smoking an imaginary cigarette.
Answer her question, I said.
No comment.
Thomas, look, man, you want to get out of this place, don't you? Maybe go back to settle for a while? Back to your coffee wagon?
In the midst of the city street, on both sides of the river, was the tree of life, he said.
Closed his eyes.
Bearing 12 fruits, yielding its fruit according to each month, and the leaves for the healing of the nations.
Answer her question, I said.
His eyes sprang open.
I am answering it, he snapped. I was following a biblical dictate. I cut off my hand to heal the nations.
I was beginning to lose it.
You listening to me, Thomas? You got to lay off that Bible bullshit and play it smart with these security board honchos. If they ask you if you regret what you did in the library, you tell them yes. You regret it. And if they say, whatever happened to Dessa anyway, he said.
Dessa came to see me when I was in the hospital, he told Sheffer.
Listen!
She loves me. I'm still her friend whether she and Dominic are married or not.
This was hopeless.
I'll just tell them the truth, Thomas said, that I had to make a holy sacrifice to prevent Armageddon.
His face looked suddenly arrogant, clenched. His cheeks flushed.
It would have worked, too, if they hadn't sequestered me like this, silenced me.
His face contorted. He began to sob.
They torture me here, he shouted.
The guard moved closer. Sheffer held up her hand.
Who does? I said. Who tortures you? The voices?
You think putting insects in my food is the worst of it? Well, it isn't. They hide snakes in my bed, stick razor blades in my coffee, push their elbows against my throat.
Who does?
I'm unclean, Dominic. They have keys. They rape me.
Okay, I said. All right. Calm down.
Sneak into my cell at night and rape me.
He pointed across the table at Sheffer.
She's nice. She and Dr. Gandhi, but they have no idea what goes on behind their backs. At night, no one does. I'm public enemy number one because I have the power to stop this war. But they don't want it stopped. They want me silenced.
Who does?
Use your head for once. Read Apocalypse.
I stood up and started around that massive table toward him.
Whoa, whoa, wait a minute, the guard said. Hospital requires you keep a distance of 5 feet from the patients while...
Thomas stood. I took him in my arms. He fell against me, stiff as a 2x4.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you...
Sheffer got up, stepped between the guard and the two of us. Thomas sobbed, and I held him. Rocked in my arms... until he was quiet. I never did show up at the Roods that afternoon. I drove around and around and ended up at the falls, watching the spilling water, pulling one rolling rock after another out of the carton. By the time I got back to the condo, it was after 8. The lights were on. The Duchess's car was parked out in front. Why didn't that little faggot just pack his bags and come live with us? Why didn't we just charge him rent, for Christ's sake? I unloaded the antifreeze, the paint thinner, grabbed my notes for the hearing, my dry-clean suit. What was that on the front step? A jack-o'-lantern smiling out at nothing. I considered hauling off and drop-kicking the fucker across the yard. Went inside instead.
Hi, Dominic, Joy said.
I clunked the stuff I was holding onto the kitchen counter.
Hi, Dominic, the Duchess chimed in. Want some toasted pumpkin seeds?
He was pulling a cookie sheet from the oven. I walked past him without a word. Drop-kick him, too, if he didn't stay the fuck away from me. In the bedroom, I flopped face down on the mattress. Rolled over. Started reading through my notes on the hearing. Joy came in and closed the door behind her.
Okay, Dominic, she said. I know you have a lot on your mind with that hearing thingy tomorrow. But that doesn't give you the right to walk in and be totally rude to my friends.
Get him out of here, I said.
Why should I? This is my house, too, you know. If I want to relax after work and have my friends over, I sent my notes flying across the bedroom, papers fluttering to the floor.
Stood up. Should I tell her I'd seen her little pregnancy test? Have our little showdown right then and there? I was tempted, still buzzed enough from those beers out at the falls to start something. But I needed to save my energy for the hearing. Get into this at a later date. I walked past her. Went into the bathroom to take a leak. When I came back in the bedroom, she hadn't moved.
I'm sick of it, she said. I'm sick of you being this big martyr all the time.
Look, I said, I know you couldn't give a flying fuck about whether he stays down there at that place and rots. I know that. I accept that. But I got an obligation, okay? Now I need to go over these papers, prepare for tomorrow. Then I need to eat something, some real food, I mean, not toasted pumpkin seeds. Then I need to get some sleep. So just get your little boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever he is out of here.
How about what I need? Do you ever think about what I need, Dominic?
I mean it, Joy. Get him out before I go out there and fucking throw him out. She stood up, glaring at me, walked to the door and slammed it behind her. Out in the kitchen, there was mumbling between them. Then the TV went dead. Then, in this order, I heard back door, car doors, ignition. Joy? I got off the bed, opened the door.
Joy?
Somewhere during the night, I dreamt that Dessa was doing me, slipping my cock in and out of her mouth.
She hadn't left me then? We were still together?
Then the sweet rush of release. I woke up coming. Saw Joy's head move away. Saw Joy reach up and tuck her bangs behind her ear. I lay there catching my breath, letting the spasms die away. Joy pulled tissues from the box on her nightstand, started cleaning us up. I reached over for her, but she took my hand and led it away from her, parked it back on the mattress. Sometime, with Joy, sex wasn't so much something we shared together, but a service she performed. She turned on the table lamp, traced and retraced the line of my eyebrow with her finger.
Dominic, she said, I have something to tell you, something big. I didn't want to say anything until I was sure, and now I am sure. I'm pregnant.
She took my hand.
We made a baby, Dominic, you and me.
I reached over and turned off the light. In those few seconds of absolute darkness, before my eyes adjusted, it felt like we were in some place more open and wide than our bedroom. Like we were falling together somewhere in space. The thump outside woke me up. Raccoons, I thought. Rolled over. If she just put the damn garbage lids on tight.
We made a baby, Dominic. You and me.
They raped me.
I don't think about it now, I told myself. Don't think. Take deep breaths. Sleep. 1:07 a.m., according to the clock radio. Well, it was finally here. D-Day. The day of his hearing. I had to get out of the condo. I drove through downtown, up River Avenue, to Cider Mill and Route 162. My eyes burned, my stomach hurt from sleeplessness. Everywhere I drove, smashed pumpkins were in the road. I took a left onto the parkway. It was a relief to drive past the state hospital for once. The roads were slick from a mist so soft and light, it seemed to hang suspended in the air around the street lamps. I exited in Easterly and drove up Route 22, out by the Waquonic Reservation. As close as I can figure, that's when I must have started dozing. I awoke to a car horn's blare. Jesus! Jesus! A rock ledge rushed past, headlights crisscrossed in front of me. I veered to the right and drove over an embankment, unsure how far I'd fall. There was an ugly scraping sound beneath me. I remember the wail of my own, oh no, oh no! My head bounced against the roof. Barreling toward that tree, I held up my hand to stop the collision.
I was out for a little while, I guess. I must have been. I remember pulling my hand back inside the busted windshield. Remember the pain, the pulsing blood. In the moonlight, my blood looked black. Up on Route 22, I saw a vision. The steady flow of gamblers in cars, driving to the Wakonics Casino. Ray braked slowly, cautiously, gliding over the speed bumps on the way out of the dealership, where I'd had the totaled truck towed.
"You didn't say over the phone that you got hurt," he said. "What's the matter with your hand?"
I filled him in on the 17 stitches, the pain in my neck. The two codeine pills I'd gotten at the hospital had begun to kick in nicely, though. The pain was still there. I just didn't give a shit about it.
"So what are you planning to do for transportation?"
I told him I hadn't gotten that far yet. I looked out the side window, watched Three Rivers go by.
"Why didn't they give you one of those collar things at the hospital, if your neck's bothering you?"
"I'm all right, Ray," I said. "I'm fine."
"Well, you don't look fine. You look like hell. You had any breakfast?"
I told him I wasn't hungry, that what I wanted was to get my prescription filled and then go over to the Rood's house on Gillette Street, pull those shutters and get back home, grab a nap if I had time, clean up, and then get ready for the hearing. He couldn't help me today, he said. He had a doctor's appointment. But he could give me a hand the next day. I told him the doctor who'd stitched me up hadn't said anything about restricting myself. Ray poked me awake. We were in the parking lot at Colburn's Pharmacy. Did I want him to get me one of those neck collar things while I was in there?
What?
No. When we got to Rood's house, Ray told me he'd swing by and pick me up as soon as he got out of the doctor's.
"Maybe I'll stop by the medical supply place first and get you one of those collars," he said, "just in case you want it later."
I got out of the car. He warned me not to overdo it. He could help me tomorrow, he reminded me. If the Roods couldn't wait one more day, then fuck 'em. I'd been there half an hour or more, had managed to pull most of the downstairs shutters, when Ruth Rood came out onto the porch in her bathrobe. She just stood there, her hands wringing a dish towel, the same way Ma used to do when she was nervous. Ruth looked like she wanted to say something.
"How's it going?" I said.
I kept working, trying to loosen a rusted hinge screw with my good hand.
"It might be better if you just left now," she said. Can you just go?"
I told her that I'd wrecked my truck, that I couldn't leave until my ride got there. God, I hated these people.
"All right," she said.
She turned and went back inside the house. I was pissed. Hand or no hand, sore neck or not, I dragged and yanked and raised my extension ladder until it rested against the second story. One-handed, I gripped the side of the ladder and started to climb. One thing about working angry, it made the adrenaline pump. My hand was starting to throb like a bastard. Still no Ray. I reached into my shirt pocket, fished out the last of the pain pills. If I took it now, I'd be clear-headed by 4 o'clock. How was I supposed to go home and sleep if I was in this much pain? Sheffer would love that, though, me arriving for the big hearing stoned. I looked up at those third-floor shutters. If I got that last pair of shutters down, then that'd be all of them. I flip-flopped my 30-foot extension ladder over to the widow's walk. It'd be easier than the second-floor windows, actually. Just climb over that little railing and onto the porch up there. I climbed up, up, over the railing. From up there, I could see a little sliver of the river, even. I had to get home, go over those notes for the hearing a few more times. Grab a shower. I must be getting pretty rank by now. Doctor had said not to get the bandage wet, to wear a plastic bag or something. Hurry up, Ray. The left shutter came off easily. The window frame was so rotted out, I could pull the hinge screws out by hand after the first few turns. It might be a bitch to get that shutter back in there tight, but getting it off was no problem. I lifted it, adjusting it as best I could for the climb back over the railing, the descent. Something moved against my hand, a leathery flutter against my wrist. Jesus, I muttered, letting the shutter go. It banged against the railing, bounced, fell over the side. I was watching it break apart on the ground below when a black blur flew back up at me. A goddamn bat. I stared at it, and it stared back, cocked its little walnut-sized head and studied me. When it opened its jaws and hissed, I was close enough to see the pinkish-gray inside of its mouth, its little saber teeth. My heart chugged. I broke out in a sweat. I reached into my tool belt and found some glazing points, started pelting them at it. It hissed again, flapped its wings, and flew to a nearby tree. "And stay there," I said, leaned against the house for a second to let the wooziness pass. That's when I saw him. Rude. He was standing there at the attic window, staring. Was he looking at me? Past me? It was scary the way he kept looking. And there I was, too, my reflection in the glass superimposed over him. "What?" I said. "What do you want?" He thought, "Get away from me, man. Stop staring." He put the gun in his mouth. I stumbled back. Fell. The rush toward the ground was soundless. I could see them both, in slow motion and in a gleaming streak. My daughter and my mother. Angela spun in a kind of pirouette. She was wearing a pure white dress. Miguel, the night nurse, lifted the blanket and sheet to have a look. I raised my head, looked down at my swollen, stapled leg, my purple eggplant of a foot. "Jesus, what a mess," I said. Looked away and shuddered. "Could have been worse, man," Miguel said. "Could have been worse." According to Miguel, when the EMTs had arrived at 207 Gillette Street in response to Ruth Rude's hysterical 911 call, they'd found me unconscious in the front yard, adrift on a pile of broken shutters. The medics made two incorrect assumptions, that I was Henry Rude, and that the tumble I'd taken was the suicide attempt Mrs. Rude had been screaming about over the phone. They had me sedated and were readying me for transport before someone finally deciphered Ruth Rude's ranting about the attic, her husband, the gun he'd fired into his head. Henry Rude had been pronounced dead on arrival at Shanley Memorial, Miguel said, although he'd probably died a second or two after he pulled the trigger. According to what his friend had told him, the back half of Rude's head was all over the wall and the floor. Dr. David Spencer, chief of orthopedic surgery, made the decision that my shattered foot and ankle and the broken and dislocated bones of my lower leg required reconstructive surgery right away, that night. The operation began shortly after 7 o'clock and lasted until sometime after midnight, by which time 14 bones and bone fragments had been rejoined with screws and plastics and two curved steel plates. My leg had so much metal in it, Miguel said, it could probably conduct electricity. What day is it anyway? I asked. It's Saturday, he said. He craned his neck around to see the clock in the corridor. 1:35 a.m. Saturday? How can it be Saturday? Because yesterday was Friday, man. You've been in and out of it for a couple of days now. More out than in, to tell you the truth. It began to sink in. I had never made it to Thomas's hearing. I'd blown it for my brother. My brother, did you hear anything about what happened to him? The next morning, Sheffer called. How are you? When I found out what happened, I was like, oh my God. I asked her if they'd postponed the hearing. There was a pause. They went ahead. Where is he? Where is he? Now? He's at Hatch, Dominic. Look, let me just make sure my friend can watch Jesse for an hour or so, and I'll get there as soon as I can, okay? I got the phone back on the cradle, but dropped the whole damn thing trying to get it back on the nightstand. When I looked over at the other bed, I saw my roommate, lying on his side, awake, watching me. Getting out of bed, he let go a long, rumbling fart. Whoops. Excuse me, he said. He picked up the phone. He looked down at my uncovered leg, my foot. Ooh, baby, that's got a smart, he said. How's it feel? I shrugged. Not bad. I guess they got me pretty well doped up. I'm in here with a bum gut, he said.
bleeding ulcer. They just want to watch me through the weekend. I'm probably checking out on Monday.
Uh-huh. Good.
I closed my eyes, listened to him scuff back to bed. My name's Steve, he said. Steve Felice. He waited, kept looking at me. Dominic Birdsey. I reached for the phone, dialed Ray. Figured I'd give him the big medical bulletin, that I'd come back to planet Earth. But there was still no answer over there. I dialed my own house again. This time she answered, groggy-voiced. It's me, I said. I'm back from the dead. There was a pause at the other end.
Dominic?
Yeah? You didn't cash in my life insurance policy yet, did you? She sounded relieved. I'll give her that. She kept repeating my name. Joyce said she'd be down to see me as soon as she got cleaned up and had something to eat. If she could even stand to eat. We hung up. Oh, hey, I forgot to tell you, Felice said. My fiancée says she knows you. I closed my eyes. When I opened my eyes, a chubby black nurse was standing beside my bed taking my pulse. I'm Vanette, she said. Scheffer approached the bed, a smile blinking on and off. Oh, I said. Hi. Hi. She was holding a pot of yellow chrysanthemums and a small wrapped gift. These are for you, she said. The little one's from Dr. Patel. The flowers are from me. She thunked the mums down on my nightstand. I looked over at Steve Felice's bed. Empty, the sheets rucked up, TV off. I told Scheffer I appreciated her coming down. It's not good, is it? She shook her head. It's not what you wanted. By a unanimous vote, Scheffer said, the Psychiatric Security Review Board had decided to retain my brother for a period of 1 year.